Welcome, everyone. I'm Marcy Frederick. I'm the director of the Hartzler Library just down the hill. And that's where the exhibition that prompted the series of lectures is being housed. And I invite you to come down there. It's open anytime the library is open, which Monday through Thursday is 7:45 in the morning to 11:30 at night. On Friday from 7:45 in the morning until 8 at night. And on Saturday from 10 until 6. And Sunday from 2 until 11:30 at night. So there's plenty of time for you folks to get down there. The exhibition is on from, it's open now, it's on through November 17. This is the first of four events, and I have some brochures that I'll put out in the back there for the others. The next one is Wednesday, October 17. That is a university colloquium, so it's being held at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the Main Stage Theater. Duane Stoltzfus, who's professor of communication at Goshen College, has written a book called Pacifists in Chains, The Persecution of Hutterites During the Great War, and that's what he's going to speak about. But this evening, I'm happy to have with us Phil Niss, who is senior pastor at Parkview Mennonite Church since 1996. And among other things, he is sings with the men's a cappella ensemble Cantore, and he's very serious about coffee, he says. Some of you may know more about that than I do. He holds a Master of Divinity degree from Eastern Mennonite Seminary, a Doctor of Ministry from Northern Seminary in Lombard, Illinois. He's married to Irene Hirschberger Niss, and the couple has three daughters, two sons-in-law, and three grandchildren. And he's here to tell us the story of his grandfather, Loy Niss. So please welcome Phil Niss.
Well, thank you all for coming. I want to especially welcome other members of the Loy Niss family. I see his daughter Esther and her husband Myron there, and I see one of his great-granddaughters there in the back, who's a current EMU student. And I'm sure there's others who are related in some way or know them or have some relationship with maybe met or appreciated Loy earlier in life. So thanks too for the EMU Library for bringing this very important Voices of Conscience exhibition to us here in this community. So I do hope you all stop by the EMU Library and take a look at that. And thanks for the invitation to share this story as part of this series. These stories are now 100 years old. And there are no more conscientious objectors to World War I living among us to tell us firsthand what it was like to refuse to participate in an immensely popular war. So we rely on events like this to help keep these stories alive. And I believe these stories have still great significance for us, to our lives, especially in these troubled and violent times that we live in. World War I has gone down in history as the Great War. The nickname fits, insofar as it describes the size of the conflict and the extent of the suffering that it caused and the impact that it had on the world that emerged from its ashes. And in every one of those ways, it was a great war whose reverberations are still being felt today. For Mennonites and brethren of the early 20th century, the Great War turned into a great test. It was a major test of the capacity of the faith and life of these people to maintain their pacifist and non-resistant convictions and a strong communal identity while living in a world that turned out to be unexpectedly and suddenly hostile to them. The Anabaptists were known as being the quiet in the land, and these quiet people were suddenly thrust into the public eye. Their way of responding to the war confused and offended the world around them and put them in direct opposition to momentum that was building outside their close communities. In a world of war hysteria, being quiet and invisible was not an option anymore for rural, peaceable Mennonites. So that's the big story that shapes my talk tonight, the great war that became the great test for my own faith community. The smaller story is that of my paternal grandfather, Loy Niss. Loy was born 121 years ago in 1897 and died almost 40 years ago. While I was growing up in Florida, my grandparents lived in Maryland and then in Virginia, but I nevertheless had a very close relationship with Grandpa Niss. Our family made it a priority to travel north often when I was a child. And for my last 2 years of high school, in the mid-70s, I lived with Grandpa and Grandma here in Harrisonburg as a boarding student at EMHS. So tonight's story of Loy Niss will not be entirely objective. It will be told by someone who has a deep love and affection for the main character in the story. I trust that will help the telling and not hinder it. But full disclosure, that's not my only bias or angle in this story. I come from a very specific Anabaptist Mennonite tree, the tree that formed me as a Mennonite follower of Christ and also formed my grandfather and most others in my family. That same tree also shaped most Mennonites who live in the Shenandoah Valley. We sometimes call that tree the Old Mennonites. Identified as such because we arrived in the old days, early 1700s, as opposed to those who migrated from Europe 200 years later. It's important to locate myself in this story because, as you will see, if you don't already know, there are many different Mennonite cultural and theological contexts in North America, and each one of those responded to the Great War a little differently. I think the exhibit and the lectures in this series will bear that out. So old Mennonites living in the East is my grandfather's context, and it's my context. There are other Mennonite World War I CO stories also needing to be told, but they need to be told by other people. There are others who suffered far worse fates than my grandfather, and I want to honor their memory tonight as well. But my bias, my angle, means that the story of Loy Niss is the one story that I can tell and that I must tell. Bias just is. It's not good or bad. What's important is you know that it's there and that you acknowledge it and that you put it to worthwhile use. So that's what I hope to do tonight. I want to acknowledge several sources that I drew on tonight. One is the book American Mennonites in the Great War, 1914 to 1918 by the Dutch-American historian Gerlof Homan. Another nice surprise in getting ready for this talk last year was finding a doctoral dissertation by Donald Eberle for his 2003 PhD from Bowling Green State University. And he did his dissertation on conscientious objection in World War I, and he had extensive quotes from government and military files that I had not seen before, as well as from church statements, so that was very helpful. There's also a file on my grandfather at the Meadow Simons Historical Library here on campus, and some material in the Swarthmore College piece collection that I drew on. Finally, Grandpa was great at documenting his own experience. I have two booklets that he published, one by Herald Press and one by Christian Light Publications. I also have audio and video recordings of him telling his story and a few unpublished notes and letters that he wrote. He was a teacher in one form or another. His whole adult life and well into his retirement, his teaching often included stories. I can't tell you how many times I saw him in his study poring over his books, his Bible, writing letters, writing stories to share. I'm sitting in the very same desk chair that he sat in to write nearly all his stories and sermons and articles and lectures. And right beside his desk was this wooden stand, which held a very large and heavy dictionary. So I have these items here in honor of Grandpa's life of study and storytelling. Mennonites and World War I are both, on their own, complicated realities. Put them together and that complexity multiplies. Any attempt to do a brief summary will, by definition, be a gross oversimplification, and that's what I'm about to do, and you'll just have to put up with that. The U.S. was later than most nations in joining the war. Many Americans were happy for Woodrow Wilson to drag his feet, but Mennonites in particular put a great deal of hope in Wilson as the peace president. So when war was finally declared on Germany in April 1917, Anabaptists were surprised, disappointed, and in large part unprepared. They had to scramble to form some kind of response. Meanwhile, American society was in the middle of pre-war era of optimistic progressivism, what historian James Yonke called years of confident reformist nationalistic zeal. People saw the Great War as an opportunity to advance this progressivist agenda, to enhance democracy at home and abroad. Political and religious leaders alike were confident that they knew the cause of evil in the world, and this war to promote democratic ideals that would bring about good for everyone. They were optimistic, and their progressive ideals were embraced by nearly everyone. Christian churches everywhere got on board, including evangelical Protestants. American Mennonites, meanwhile, at least my stream of Mennonites, were mostly leading a quiet rural life focused on farming, family, and the church. They were non-resistant pacifists, but they were mostly uninvolved in the political apparatus. They did not play an active part in public discourse about democracy and social progressivism. So it was inevitable that Mennonites in the U.S. would be squeezed between a rock and a hard place when the U.S. joined a popular war defending widely accepted American political ideals, ideals that Mennonites had very little interest or investment in. For Mennonites to sit out a conflict that every other American saw as essential to the survival of everything they held dear pretty much guaranteed that Mennonites would find little sympathy in the world around them. To make matters worse, much worse, in the early 1900s, Mennonites were predominantly German, ethnically and historically. And many of them still spoke German in their homes and churches, and the country was becoming rabidly anti-German. This was not limited to extremist fringe groups. Fear of anything German was widespread. A bill was even introduced in the House of Representatives in 1918 to force states and towns to change all German place names to something more American and to prohibit U.S. mail from being delivered to any town or street whose name was not changed. Now, that bill failed to pass, so that's probably why you haven't heard about it. But many towns did, in fact, take action to change hundreds of place names during the war. You all know Liberty Street running through downtown Harrisonburg. Before the war, on all the maps, it's German Street. It wasn't just streets that were renamed. Sauerkraut became Liberty Cabbage and all kinds of other things. So Mennonites found themselves under pressure. And that pressure hit the boiling point when Mennonite young men were drafted and forced to become U.S. soldiers. Things quickly got complicated because there were different Mennonite groups with different histories and different subcultures and different convictions on how the church should relate to society. There was not one unified Mennonite witness to the government or society. At one point, there were three different official delegations going to Washington and appealing directly to Newton Baker, Secretary of War. Those who took a softer stand especially on the issue of non-combatant service, actually made it more difficult for those who showed up later in Mr. Baker's office with a more rigid prohibition against all military service. And there were various Mennonite assemblies producing official statements that did not entirely agree. Notably, General Conference of Mennonites, along with Mennonite Brethren and other groups, held a series of gatherings in the Midwest for several decades called the All Mennonite Convention. Only it wasn't quite all Mennonite, since we old Mennonites were mostly absent, or at least sitting around the edges of those assemblies. We were pretty leery of anything ecumenical, including with other more worldly Mennonites, many of whom supported non-combatant service. The All Mennonite Convention produced a statement that could be described as tepid. It made an appeal to the government to find solutions other than war to resolve conflict, but it did not draw any line in the sand, did not provide much guidance to its own young people as to how they should respond. The old Mennonites, on the other hand, got very specific and direct. In 1915, in Archbold, Ohio, their conference produced a statement forbidding participating in carnal warfare. It stipulated that members who bore arms were to be disowned from membership. 2 years later, after the draft was instituted, there was more to say. At Yellow Creek Church, near Goshen, Indiana, 189 old Mennonite delegates signed a statement, Mennonites on Military Service. And that statement addressed the government directly, urging them to change the Selective Service law. They said, quote, "It is our hope that when the powers that be fully understand our position with reference to military service, that the law pertaining to non-combatant service might be accordingly modified." In stating their difficulty with non-combatant service, they said, "We have always endeavored to support the government under which we have lived in every capacity consistent with the teaching of the gospel as we understand it, and will continue to do so. But according to this teaching, we cannot participate in war in any form, that is, to aid or abet war, whether in a combatant or non-combatant capacity." And in a section called To Our Brethren Liable for Military Service, that was the title of the piece, they said that when they were summoned to enter the military, they should, quote, "present themselves to the authority and meekly inform them that under no circumstances can they consent to service, either combatant or non-combatant, under the military arm of the government," unquote. And finally, they were instructed to submit, quote, "to any penalty the government may see fit to inflict, trusting the Lord for guidance and protection," unquote. Now, this statement was not well received by certain members of the government and the military. The chief of military intelligence wrote a letter to the head of the FBI stating that he read this statement, Mennonites on Military Service, and commented that the list of church heads and officials appear to be largely German or of German extraction. It would seem that this resistance to the generous provisions of the selective draft law regarding conscientious objectors is a very insidious piece of pro-German propaganda. He told the FBI director, quote, "that an investigation of the Mennonites and their activities might bring to light interesting revelations." I'm not sure how thorough the FBI investigation was, but it probably lasted more than 1 week. The group at Yellow Creek appointed a peace problems committee consisting of Aaron Lukes, S.G. Shetler, and D.D. Miller, who arranged a meeting directly with the Secretary of War, Baker. S.G. Shetler was my grandfather Loy's pastor and bishop, and incidentally was the original owner of this desk chair before he passed it on to his protege, Loy Niss. So there's another good reason for me to be sitting in it tonight. The three men, Aaron, S.G., and D.D. Miller, reported that they were favorably received, and Secretary Baker assured them that, quote, and this is them quoting in their report, that none of our brethren need serve in any capacity which violates their creed and consciences. That once they arrived in camp, having stated their non-resistant position, they could expect to be placed in detention camps where they would be properly fed and cared for. While in camp, they would not be uniformed or drilled. So that seemed like good news. Unfortunately, then, as now, what happens in Washington sometimes stays in Washington. What is politically expedient for those at the top doesn't always get implemented away from Washington by those with boots on the ground. So what Secretary Baker described to the committee rarely actually happened. In fact, it was discovered later that in October 1917, after this meeting with the Mennonite leaders, that the War Department issued a confidential order advising military commanders that most COs could be convinced to renounce their religious objections. And now, conveniently, the officers were not told what steps they could or could not take. At least implicitly, they were encouraged to experiment and report the results of their efforts to help determine which methods were most successful in converting conscientious objectors to soldiers. Unfortunately, the U.S. government underestimated the strength of Mennonites' communal and faith identity, and sadly, Mennonites overestimated the government's generosity in accommodating them. My grandfather was caught in the middle of that. Loy Niss lived in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and was a member of the Stahl Mennonite Church. He received training to be a public school teacher and had taught for 3 terms before receiving notice that he was drafted to serve in the military. And this is a photo of him with his students in his one-room schoolhouse in Johnstown. Grandpa was drafted on September 6, 1918, 100 years and 1 month ago, barely 2 months before the armistice was signed. He was discharged in January of 1919 after completing a bit more than 4 months in the Army, but a lot happened in those 4 months. When he and several other young men in the congregation were called up in the draft, they held a farewell meeting at the Stahl Church with everyone in his church family in attendance. Grandpa says that these meetings were impressive. They gave the young men good advice and words of encouragement publicly. One thing he remembers specifically was the admonition not to fear those who can destroy only the body, but rather fear the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. On September 7, 1918, he went to this train station in Pittsburgh with his father and younger brother, and as a train pulled out, he looked out the window and saw his little brother crying. It was quite a trip for this conservative Pennsylvania farm boy and rural teacher. He wrote, "I came to Camp G bright and early on Sunday morning, September 8, 1918. I experienced quite an unusual night on the train previous to this. Young men full of life, away from their parents, good influence, parents, friends, and the opposite gender gave vent to all the vile expressions imaginable." In his book that he wrote, he elaborated on that statement, saying, quote, "The young men abandoned all self-restraint and discipline, shouting and using foul language, even blaspheming, so that the situation was like a riot. It seemed to me that they were all controlled by some demonic spirit. I had never seen anything like that before. I just sat back in my seat, dazed and bewildered all night. The destination was Camp Greenleaf in Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, just across the state line south of Chattanooga, Tennessee. As he got off the train, he was given a folding cot, two blankets, a mess kit, a tin bucket, a bar of soap. One of the two blankets he was given is here on this table up here at the front, which I hope you take a look at tonight along with other items there. As soon as he could, he told an officer that he was a CO and asked for consideration, I suppose expecting to be shown where to go to the CO camp. The officer cursed at him and said, "You'll be proud of yourself." And Grandpa took that to be some kind of threat. Grandpa was a shy young man and not quick to make new friends. In this context, it was also a way to survive. He was one of eight in his tent, and he never learned the other boys' names. As soon as they learned he was a CO, they avoided him. There were 250 men in his company. Soon they all knew who he was, and as he walked down the street in front of the tents, they would shout, "Shoot him! Hang him! Come in and pray with us. He's yellow," and things like that. One of the things Loy was prepared for by his church and strongly counseled by his ministers, including S.G. Shetler, was that above all, Loy had to be consistent in disobeying all military orders. Any command that would involve being part of the military system. The other strong counsel he received from his church was not to sign any papers anytime. He was given many orders every day, often to do some kind of work. And each time he had to decide how to respond. Most orders he disobeyed. A few that had to do with maintaining his own environment, for instance, cleaning up in and around his tent, he would do. But other orders he refused. He understood that it was important to be entirely consistent, or he would be caught as being insincere and potentially court-martialed. He writes that he was tense about this all day, every day. Every time the corporal blew his whistle, he startled with fear. He disobeyed the order to go with his company to the drill field to practice marching without guns. Two strong soldiers were ordered to physically take him on both sides and walk him to the field. They had to physically put him in line where he belonged with soldiers in front and behind him. And when the company was told to march, Loy stood still. The drill sergeant told those behind him to push him forward, but he would not keep in step, aggravating everyone around him. The sergeant then ordered the other boys to kick him on the shins and ankles and stomp on his feet with their heavy army boots. This treatment kept up for a number of days until they tired of it and they let him stay in his tent. One day his name appeared on the bulletin board for KP duty the next morning, involving preparing breakfast and washing dishes. That night he prayed for guidance. Would his conscience and his church allow this or not? He reported to duty, but told the mess sergeant he could not do the work. He was cursed again and told to go back to his tent and rot. His name appeared the next day, but since he had already explained himself, he decided to stay in his tent. Again, two soldiers came and physically escorted him, and as they climbed the narrow steps into the mess hall, where there's only room for one person side by side, the one soldier went behind, kicking him at every step, and the sergeant again ordered him to work, and Loy refused. Later, when writing up his experiences, he noted wryly, "They gave me the privilege of standing at attention in the mess hall all day long," which means no moving of his head, arms, or legs. In his book, he wrote that about 1,000 men ate in the hall, and after they were all finished eating, he was told that he could eat his breakfast, and then he stood at attention again until lunchtime, during which the hall of Men filled up again, and alternately they jeered him or cursed him. And after they finished, he ate lunch again by himself, then stood at attention until dinner, and then he was permitted to go back to his tent. One day he was asked to clean up the streets, meaning pick up all the trash around the camp. He writes, "It was a worthwhile work, but it was part of the whole military system, and helping would be taking part in the machine intended to kill the enemy. I had to refuse." A gang of 12 men worked together, with two of them carrying a box with handles in the front and the back where the trash was thrown, and the rest would be picking up the trash and throwing it into the box. Since he wouldn't pick up any trash, the sergeant told him to carry one end of the box. Well, he refused. The sergeant lifted up the box and put the handle in Loy's hands, and when he let go, Loy's hands relaxed and the box fell. Again, laughter and cursing. The sergeant had two soldiers take off their belts, and they used the belts to wrap around and fasten the handle to Loy's hands. The man holding the back of the box had to push to make Loy walk. But since the street was on a slope and Loy was making no effort of his own, they soon ended up on the downhill side of the street against a building. They switched ends and put Loy in the back, and he was pulled along. And they piled all the stones they could find into the back of the box where Loy was until it got too heavy for the poor soldier in the front to pull. So they let Loy go and had him stand at attention at the end of the street. He writes later to explain himself, quote, "I had no desire to disobey. I had been brought up to respect those in authority, but my deep desire to obey God caused me to react in ways that must seem like sheer stubbornness. My attitude in these situations was not one of purposeful negative confrontation with the powers of government. If there was any confrontation, it was in my own soul between what I knew was right and the compromise my carnal self would have preferred to take. What I suffered at the hands of these officers was nothing to what I would have suffered if I had violated my conscience." When the military uniforms arrived a few weeks in, Loy refused to put it on. He was called then to the camp storeroom, accompanied by other officers, and he was told to take off his clothes. Since that was not an order that advanced the military cause, he complied. They put his clothes in a suitcase and told him they were being sent home. Then they physically dressed him in the uniform, one arm and one leg at a time. They buttoned his coat, leaving an extra button at the top and an extra hole at the bottom. They left the front of his trousers hanging open. And they led him to the street and blew the whistle, calling all 250 men in the company to line up along both sides, and they had a one-man parade, with everyone mock cheering or cursing as he was led down the street. Once Loy had been forcibly dressed in the uniform and he had no other clothes available to him, he agonized, but his conscience allowed him to dress himself the next morning. He spent 3 days in solitary confinement in the prison once for disobeying orders. He talks about those three long and lonely days spent laying on his cot with his face to the wall, watching bedbugs climbing up and down the wall. Twice during his relatively short time in the camp, Loy lost a grandmother in death. Both times, he was refused a pass home for the funeral. Here's what he said about the one occasion, quote, "I received a sad telegram informing me of the death of my grandmother. I asked for a furlough home, but the captain refused to grant it, but instead said I should be shot down there and then. That night was a long night for me. In the evening, I lay out under the trees until late at night, giving way to my emotions. Oh, that experience." He often wondered whether there were even a few other conscientious objectors in camp. He had never met one. One Saturday evening, a lieutenant showed him some kindness and told him that the next morning, Sunday, he would have the freedom of the camp to walk anywhere he wanted to. He only told him not to leave the camp and not to talk to any farmers at the borders. So Loy decided to search for the CO detachment. In every section of the camp, there was a YMCA building, outside of which there was always a bulletin board with maps and information for people. He walked for miles, checking one YMCA after another. And at the very end of the camp, the last YMCA, he saw in the bottom corner of the map a section titled Conscientious Objector Detachment. He turned and looked and saw the tents about a block away, and his heart began to beat fast. He walked over to it, but in a roundabout way, around a pile of firewood so as not to attract attention, and he stood still and heard the sounds of gospel songs and hymns, the first he had heard since leaving home, and he sat down by the wood pile and wept until he could compose himself. And he walked into the detachment, and there were 18 boys in one tent having Sunday school. He stood at the door. They looked at him and saw the uniform and were immediately suspicious. But after he explained who he was, they warmed up and they welcomed him. They told him, "Don't worry, in a few days you will be here too. But you better move on before the guard sees you and causes trouble." They were being treated essentially as prisoners. In a week or two, Loy was transferred there. The sergeant was a large man with a large temper. One day, after refusing to do something, the sergeant called Loy into the big bathhouse. It was just the two of them. He locked the doors. And here's how Loy described that encounter. "He tried to make me obey by using his fist. I was slapped in the face, struck on the head, and various other places. He kept it up for 20 minutes or more. He gave me a blow on the head that then caught me to keep me from falling to the stone floor. He pushed me against the wall and wrung my nose. He pulled my head back by my hair and then struck me on the mouth when I answered the questions he asked me. I carried a black eye and sore, swollen face for about a week. Since then, we all get along quite well, with a few small exceptions." Loy pointed out that he was fortunate. The sergeant mistreated some other boys even worse, breaking bones in others. The story of John Bergen is chilling. That same sergeant put a noose around John's neck, tied it to a tree, and pulled him up off the ground until John Bergen went unconscious. Then he lowered it to the ground and hit him with a cattle whip until he came to. This kind of treatment was not allowed, of course, but none of the COs reported the sergeant to the higher-ups. When asked later why they didn't report him, Loy answered, "Then where would have been my non-resistance?" Loy added these words in his book that he wrote, quote, "I do not want to give any impression that such mistreatments were condoned by our government. These things were done by lower officers, and many things that were done to the young men in camp were not in any way worthy of or countenanced by our excellent government." In the CO detachment, Loy discovered that different COs had different convictions as to which work orders to disobey, which made their relationships complicated. The question of whether or not to work in the camps and what sort of work was permissible varied from one CO to another according to their conscience and according to instructions given by their ministers and bishops. And even then, it wasn't clear cut. Each man had to make judgment calls on the fly. And this was distressing to many of them, to always be deciding. I found a copy of a letter from one Moses W. Yoder, a fellow CO in the detachment, written to Aaron Lukes, chair of the Peace Problems Committee for Mennonite Church. I'm going to read parts of that letter to give you a sense of this ongoing struggle and the commitment that these young men had to be faithful to the church and not let anyone down. So it's dated Camp Greenleaf, Georgia, October 18, 1918. Dear Brother Lukes, I will today take pleasure to once more write you a few lines, and then some talk about the weather. Some time ago, I wrote to you a letter. It was several days after you made your welcome visit with us boys and never got an answer from you, so I thought I would try it once more. When you were here, I would very much have liked to have a more private conversation concerning our standing here at camp, being that we work some here, and do you think it will hinder our future anything by doing what we do? Last week, there came another one among our midst. His name is Loy Niss from Pennsylvania. When he came over to us, he would rather not work. But the sergeant took him in the bathhouse and gave him a severe beating until he promised to work. I don't believe they have any right to treat a person that way if it were made public. As long as we work, we seem to get along fine, but they won't tolerate a man who refuses to work. There are now 13 of us boys here. One came in yesterday. So you see that our little flock is slowly increasing one by one. We now have a new sergeant, and we all like him fine. He seems to be a nice fellow. Your brother in Christ, Private Moses W. Yoder. According to my sources, Moses was Old Order Amish from Napanee, Indiana. I also came into possession more recently of a copy of another brief account from a CO who spent time in the detachment at Camp Greenleaf with my grandfather, and it was written by Levi Yoder, father of Tilly Yoder, who's a member of my congregation at Parkview. Levi mentions Loy's arrival in the camp. Quote, during our Sunday school, a young man by the name of Loy Niss came to our tent to join the meeting. He sat back of a woodpile and took in our singing. He had to cry. It sounded to him like heaven. Levi also referenced the beating that Loy received in the bathhouse, although he thought it was because Loy refused to wear the uniform. So there's some discrepancy and some impressions that different people write about. Not long after that, November 11, 1918, the 100th anniversary of which is soon to happen, the armistice was signed and the war was over. It wasn't until January, however, that most boys were sent home. Loy was transferred to Camp Sherman in Ohio for 2 weeks and then released. He received a small amount of back pay, $16, that he had earlier refused, although it wasn't the full amount that he was owed. He was handed the discharge papers, and he saw with some dismay that it was on white paper, meaning that he had received an honorable discharge. He didn't want that. CO discharge papers were generally on colored paper, but he accepted that, not wanting to delay his departure. Tilly's father, Levi, also mentions his discharge papers, and he wrote, quote, January 23, 1919, I was given a green discharge paper which reads, quote, this man is a conscientious objector and has done no military duty whatsoever. He had refused to wear a uniform and is not recommended for reenlistment. Levi then adds, praise the Lord. So I think that's why Loy was disappointed at getting an honorable discharge. As Loy neared home, he changed trains in Pittsburgh at that same station I showed you a picture of a while back, late at night. The depot was full of people. Suddenly, a young man approached him out of the crowd and wanted to shake hands. He was a former corporal at Camp Greenleaf, now living in Pittsburgh. He said to Loy, I found out you were coming through here tonight on your way home, and I came to meet you to apologize for the way I treated you at camp. Loy assured him that he held nothing against him. Loy wrote, quote, this is the way I still feel today toward all the officers who didn't understand me and so mistreated me. Grandpa's stated feelings toward all those who mistreated him were surprisingly benign and even generous and good-hearted. It's difficult to imagine how he felt in the moment as he was being beaten or kicked or publicly ridiculed or made to stand at attention or locked up in a cell. I know for a fact that my grandfather was human. Visiting once a year as a young child from Florida didn't really make that fact obvious. Between his stories of the war and exciting stories from the jungle in India where he served as a missionary, Grandpa had this larger-than-life aura around him. But when I lived with him for 2 years as a teenager, I did catch a few glimpses now and then that betrayed his human nature. When I read his narrative now, I'm struck by how deep and genuinely peaceable and humble his spirit was. And I'm struck by his steadfast refusal to say anything negative about the government that was responsible for his suffering. His strong desire to keep his readers from misunderstanding his message. And I'm struck even by his bending over backward to minimize the extent of his suffering. You just heard these stories of beatings and emotional abuse. Now take a look at these handwritten words of Loy's that try to deflect any pity that anyone might be feeling toward him. First of all, I would express many thanks to the God of heaven for permitting me to again reach home safely and with such a comparatively easy time of it. I have suffered a few mild trials, but they surely were not meted out to me so sparingly through any merits of mine, but God's mercy and grace reached even me. And at the end of his handwritten reflections, he says, I only regret and ask my friends and parents to forgive me for writing such dark letters at first. I knew nothing of hard times before I came to this place, and of course, I expressed my feelings in the new environments. Now they seem only trifles. God had a purpose for every trial that he lets me go through. I'll trust him and serve him in self-denial, for his promise to keep me is true. Finally, I leave you with a one-minute, very grainy video clip from a talk he gave at EMHS while a student there. And I do this for two reasons. One, just to let you hear his voice and see what he looked like as an older man, but also because it gives a quick window into his thinking. As he answers a question from a student in the class who asked Loy why he could not at least serve as a chaplain in the military. And I was in this class when it was being recorded. I was a student at EMHS. And our teacher was Jim Rush, who's there in the back. So thank you, Jim, for your foresight in recording this lecture that Loy gave to his class. So let's listen to this one-minute clip.
We found a place as a chaplain, they would have admitted me, but I still would have been a part of the army. You see, those chaplains are drafted and supported and registered and everything. They wear uniforms. They're part of the army. And I might be making an illustration like this. Supposing somebody wanted to rob a bank, and they want to take a medicine man along. The man was a medicine bottle. If I get hurt, I want you to take care of me, the robber would say. And it took another man, if you were kind of a careless Christian, to say, maybe I'll get in trouble and need somebody to pray for me. Will you go along and pray when you get in trouble? And I'd go along with him, and the medicine man with the medicine bottle would go along, and I'd go along as a preacher to pray for him in his work, whatever that would be. Now, when the court tried the people for bank robbery, would they try to only him, or would I be included? I'd be included even though I went to pray, wouldn't I? That's where the army chaplaincy would have been exactly the same.
So that's the end of my talk, and I welcome your questions, responses. I don't know how long we're supposed to go. Marcy, do you... Thank you. I do welcome questions for some open conversation now. I won't make this take too long, but I do invite you, once we are dismissed, to come up and browse the items on this table. On this table is an enlargement of this, the picture of this of the COs of that detachment, and it includes a piece of paper there that identifies almost every person in that picture, where they were from, and what church group they were representing, as well as there are copies of his discharge papers and other military documents and books and articles that he wrote. So feel free to take a look at that. Paul.
Paul Roth, retired Church of the Brethren pastor. Really appreciate your personal presentation. Phil, this is just remarkable to give us a clearer view of what those who are so deep in their discipleship to Jesus Christ, to keep that no matter what. So thank you very much for giving this personal glimpse of your grandfather. I'm aware that in, I think it was 1917, might have been in 1918, the federal government was learning about brethren ministers who were preaching against the war bonds and preaching against the war, and agents were sent from the federal government to these congregations to arrest the ministers for sedition. Are you aware of any similar instances among the Mennonites, and also any more later statements about opposition to the war?
There's probably other people here who are more knowledgeable about that than I am. I don't have any specific stories of ministers being arrested in their churches for that, but yes, somebody there might have an answer.
I'm Simone Horst. I'm the Special Collections Librarian and Archivist here at EMU, and we have in our collection some papers about L.J. Heatwall, who was very influential in starting this school, and Ryan Benner, who was a pastor over in West Virginia, and they were both taken to trial. And if you go look at the display, we have a court drawing of the court session, and I think they had to pay fines. I don't think either of them served jail time, but here in the Valley, they were charged with the same things.
Back there in the back.
Would you make a comment about President Trump?
Not much to say there. It's interesting. I will say this, that Loy and his generation of Mennonites, and still some today, who hold to a very strict non-resistant pacifist position, do not look very kindly on those who get politically involved at all. So as courageous and brave as my grandfather was in facing the consequences of his convictions and disobeying government orders, when it came time to the Vietnam War in the 60s and 70s, he was not at all supportive of the movement in our church of young men not to register for the draft, for instance, or to protest the war actively in some way. That was not to him, that was a betrayal of a pure non-resistant position. So his position would have been disengagement from the political apparatus entirely, and humble submission to whatever laws there were, and to disobey them only when to do so would actively violate his conscience. And anything beyond that, he did not feel called to engage in politics in any way or to address injustice in high places. That's a difference today, so that today we can get more involved and speak out more in many parts of the church. But in the old Mennonites, especially those in the East, that was not looked kindly on. Yes.
My dad was at, I'm Irvin Heisman. My dad was at Camp Lee, Virginia. His blue discharge papers state refusal to uniform, no work, the total refusal there. His papers are dated 1917 to 1919 before they discharged. I don't know if there's any insight on why some of them were kept that long after the war or if there's any information on that or not. But
For Grandpa, it took about 2 months after the end of the war for him to be discharged. So that it was into the January of 1919 when he was discharged. But I think it still takes a long time to do government paperwork. And I imagine that in the 100 years ago, it took even longer. And just arranging train transportation for tens of thousands of young men back to their home areas was a complicated process. So I just imagine it took time.
I miss a lot of information on my dad because your dad was a writer, or granddad's writer, and was like relating his experience.
Yeah.
My dad would not talk about his experience.
That's very, I think that was a common experience for many who were mistreated and had mixed feelings about how they responded, perhaps even, or with the kind of treatment they got, and yeah, it wouldn't be very analogous, I think, to PTSD that some people suffer who go into the war and see direct combat. They come back wounded. So, I'm glad that Grandpa's experience, it wasn't so long term that it wounded him for life. He returned home and resumed an active role as a school teacher, became a minister and a bishop eventually. He was a missionary in India. He lived an active life and did a lot of teaching and preaching and storytelling and had many opportunities to relate his experience. As well as he took a lot of notes even, you know, I think soon after his discharge. Some of these handwritten notes were not dated, and I wish I knew more precisely how soon after his discharge he wrote them, but I think some of them were written quite soon after his discharge.
I'd like to express a word of appreciation for your grandfather and all those with him. Their experience caused other church leaders to actively work for conscientious objector status. So by the time I came along and registered, I could register as a conscientious objector, and I could then go into 1W. But it was their experience and their willingness to stand mm-hmm. that made that possible, and I think we need to express gratitude for that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I wonder what will happen if they reinstitute a draft, and if our young people behind us who have had the training that I got, that I appreciated from my church, that prepared me that when I was 18 in time to register, I knew what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mennonite young men and women, I mean, Mennonite young people were socialized already to be sort of in opposition to the broader culture around them. So it was not an entirely new thing for them to take a stand that they knew was not being shared by the whole, because that's kind of how they were shaped as a people. They were rural people who lived a life that was relatively tightly bounded against the influences of the world around them, and they just knew that they were on an alternate life path. And I think we don't have that same dynamic today. So it would be a new idea to just sort of stand up and go against the social norms. Yeah.
I'm the daughter of Loyness, Phil's aunt. I grew up all my childhood hearing so many of these stories. We had, when we were home from school in India, and the nights, lived in a jungle village, the nights were long, so on. Papa would often just sit telling us stories. And many of these stories were from camp. So what he has written in his book and what Phil has told were just part of them. I mean, things like the officer taking him to a big, what would you call it, a cesspool where the waste goes in, and said, septic tank. Your buddy was put in there, so you better recant. You'll be next. Things like that. And so we grew up hearing these stories over and over again. And he would always weep when he would talk about what the others were suffering. He never wept about his own. And it really affected our lives too.
Again, thank you all for coming. Let's have one more round of applause for Phil.
And I welcome you coming up and talking with me more and taking a look at these items and taking a look at these beautiful antique furniture pieces up here.